You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Next on the Old Mole, we have Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about the political landscape for crime and punishment in summer 2021.
Philadelphia, St. Louis, San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, all of these cities have elected prosecutors with a sharply different vision of crimes and punishment than their predecessors. Ranging left liberal to radical, they have all upended the tough-on-crime narrative that has proved so profitable for politicians as springboard to higher office all over the country. And these progressive prosecutors are an important victory of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fight for decarceration. So, Mike, how are these progressive prosecutors faring in the wake of the right-wing backlash against police reforms and rising anxiety about increases in violent crime?
Well, Jen, the news overall is good, although there has been stout resistance every step of the way from police unions, from prosecutors, even from judges who are used to the way things have been done for several decades now.
Can you talk about the role of prosecutors in the criminal justice system? We've taken this up before, but I think it's an often neglected hub of the machinery of the criminal justice system.
Well, they're the critical players. I think they're more important than judges. They're more important than legislators. They're more important than anyone because of the enormous discretion they have. They can and do choose who to prosecute and what to charge. So these people have, around the country, charged fewer people with crimes. They've made fewer enhancements. They no longer charge juveniles as adults. They've eliminated the death penalty. They've made moves toward ending cash bail. There are fewer police interactions in neighborhoods of color and poor neighborhoods. They're essentially trying to diminish the role of police and therefore of incarceration in our collective life.
So taking the case of Krasner, who had an important victory in May in Philadelphia, how did that campaign counter the opposition they faced that was clearly capitalizing on the increase in violent crime this year?
Well, that was a critical campaign for just that reason, because all of the scare talk that you hear from police unions and from supporters of the previous way of doing things has been about this explosion of gun violence, this rapid increase in crime, blamed, of course, on liberal prosecutors. But Krasner was facing exactly that situation in Philadelphia. But he argued that the fault was primarily of the pandemic. It's a shutdown of schools, summer camps, job opportunities. It was the elimination of those opportunities for young people who were committing all the crimes. We have a better understanding now of what has happened. The crime overall decreased, not increased. There are fewer rapes, fewer robberies. These are crimes of opportunity. The increase has been in gun violence because of large numbers of really ridiculously equipped guns that proliferate across this country. Most of the murders have happened, it turns out, in the same places they've always happened. There's been no spreading out beyond the normal boundaries of additional murders. So Krasner had all the bad statistics you could want, far worse than the statistics in Portland. But he pointed out successfully that the overall numbers are still far less than they were 20 or 30 years ago, that although the directionality is disturbing, it's had nothing to do with the prosecutors because the same increase has happened everywhere in the country, even where there are tough-on-crime prosecutors. And he won. He won decisively. He won because people have gotten used to and like these changes he's made. He's involving other parts of the community in restorative justice. He's spread out the criminal justice system, getting parts of it back from the police that have inherited so many different managerial tasks, and he prevailed. Now, it's a good sign, I think, for Chesa Boudin in San Francisco, George Gascon in Los Angeles, who are both facing recall campaigns. George Gascon in Los Angeles is facing a recall campaign that started the day after his election. Many of his best ideas have been put on hold by judges who are accustomed to deferring to these tough-on-crime prosecutors who have presented cases to them for many decades now. And Chesa Boudin is facing recall, but I think Krasner's results are very heartening. I think in both those cities, San Francisco and Los Angeles, there's serious money as well as lots of support for what they've done, because they've spread out the criminal justice system to parts of the community that have been excluded from it, and as well as limiting its reach.
How do these progressive approaches to the work of the DA fit with the aims of abolitionists, police abolitionists?
They're central because, as I said, prosecutors determine who gets charged with what crimes and whether or not there will be any additional enhancements. So when the police, for example, here in Portland, brought dozens and dozens of charges against demonstrators or protesters, the DA could say, I'm not going to make these formal charges. I'm just not going to do it. The DAs can decide and have decided that they will not charge anybody for prostitution or for drug possession in a small ale. You've got enormous power, and the prosecutor is the beginning of the system. The police, of course, generate the raw material, but it's the prosecutors who determine who gets processed by the system.
So, Mike, let's talk about the drama here in Multnomah County and the confrontation between Mike Schmidt, the DA's office, and the Rapid Response Team, or SWAT team, as they're known here in Portland. Officer Corey Budworth was indicted by a Multnomah County grand jury for fourth-degree assault of a protester last summer. And in response to those charges that will go forward, the entire Rapid Response Team that had included Budworth resigned in protest. Many of them are regulars now on Fox News, expressing their outrage over Mike Schmidt and the failure of the criminal justice system to back up the police here in Portland, who, after all, have been extremely stressed by carrying out their dangerous work, protecting the public. That's kind of a summary of their stance. How would you describe this dramatic confrontation and the significance of the resignation en masse of the Rapid Response Team in support of Budworth?
Jan, I see it as, although fraught with drama, as essentially politics as usual, with a soupçon of police misconduct overseeing it. If you break down what the police are complaining about, they are complaining about the fact that they are being held to the same standards of conduct as everyone else. They're saying that because of the danger and the stress and the difficulty of our job, the fact that we might have violated the law should be overlooked. It should be put in the larger context of how vital our work is. They're asking to be excused from following the law.
But the president of the police union claimed that his behavior conforms to standard police procedures. And then Mike Schmidt countered that if these are standard police procedures, we are in a very difficult situation indeed.
In some ways, it's not that hard. I mean, Schmidt has said he won't prosecute demonstrators, but he will prosecute window breakers. There's a difference. It's like the police have the authority to use a certain amount of force to restrain people in certain circumstances. But if they hit somebody or spray somebody or kick somebody for no discernible reason, that's an assault. That would be an assault if you or I did it. And it should also be an assault if a police person does.
It's a continuous refrain on the part of the police that, and supporters, even Biden, you know, and the Democrats try to pay tribute to the police who are out there every day protecting the public in the most dangerous line of work, like they're in the infantry in some war zone.
Well, it's exaggerated, as are every occupation when it's entering into, as our police are, political negotiations. The fact is that the job of being a cop ranks out of the top 25 dangerous jobs, it ranks as 22nd. It's nowhere near as dangerous as being a logger. It's less dangerous than being a crossing guard or a farmer. There's a host of jobs that are more dangerous, more risky. It's true, they must deal with people at their worst, people who are feeling tense. But the vast majority of cop work, it's demanding work like most work is. If you want to do a good job at any job, you have to be attentive. You have to be alert. And the police are saying that we should be somehow set aside from jobs, even jobs that have much higher mortality rates, in order to, I think, secure a better contract. They're essentially fighting the efforts to defund or to shift resources away from police departments. And they have sometimes been willing to give up responsibilities, like to concede to mental health workers first response in certain situations, but they want to keep their budget.
By the way, the en masse resignation of the rapid response team did not mean they were giving up their jobs. They still are employees. They are just, for now, not in that special unit. You know, I was looking up training for the rapid response team, and they are expected to be able to handle stressful situations, de-escalate. It reminds me, in medicine, you know, one of the most dangerous medical specialties is an ER doctor, because they see people who are very upset and reactive, but that doesn't give the ER doctor the right to assault them or use their medical arsenal, although sometimes they do, to quiet them. But you are, similarly in psychiatry or mental health field, you are trained to not take it personally when someone calls you names. You know, as a mental health professional myself, I've been in many situations where I've been dealing with people who are very hostile, and yet you're trained not to take it personally. Yet these riots
is the job of being a police officer.
It is the job. That's what you're paid to do, is to not take it personally. And so this kind of interests me as a side story, the SWAT team with all of their massive arsenal and militarized presence, why they are not able to respond to protesters who are clearly angry at the police and probably do call them names. But that sense of outrage in response to demonstrators, and the claim that the police are so demoralized they can't find their replacements. I mean, what do you make of that? Is that just a rhetorical strategy to win more resources back?
It's that, and it's also personal, and it's also a sense of the world slipping through their fingers that they have owned so clearly. I mean, just 3 days ago, a Portland police officer who had been fired for blatant screw-ups on the job got his job back. It's virtually impossible to fire a cop in Portland, Oregon right now, no matter how ineffective, desultory, lazy, or mean he or she may be.
And why is that?
It has to do with the political structure of the police union, the whole structure of arbitration. There are efforts in the legislature to change that. There are efforts being made all over the place. Some of them are successful. Most of them are continue to fail, but they keep coming back. So the police are losing the sort of infinite amount of authority they've had in this town. There was a brief period when the Justice Department oversaw Portland's police department, primarily because the police kept shooting these mentally ill people. Since then, they've believed that they've gotten that burden removed from their shoulders. But now the whole Black Lives Matter movement and what happened in the wake of the murder of George Floyd has led to a significant loss of prestige and actual loss of material goods. People are renegotiating contracts all over the country, particularly here in Portland. And there was that long, strange period after the triumphant kicking out of the feds from the federal building downtown, where demonstrations continued. And I think they presented a picture of why it's a good thing rather than a bad thing that these people have all resigned. Because I think a lot of the protesters and the cops were personally into it with each other. And it sort of degenerated through the fall. And the people who have resigned had all kinds of personal beefs and gripes with individuals. I think it's so much better to distribute that work. It's tough work, the nighttime work, around different members of the police department, rather than having the so-called specialized unit, because they have no particular additional skills. They were just people who were assigned to that job. But the mass resignation, as you say, it did not involve them actually resigning from their job. They resigned from a particular assignment.
So maybe we should celebrate their resignation.
It's not a bad thing in any way.
Not a bad thing. Okay. Okay, well, Mike, there'll be more to follow around these themes of law and order and decarceration as we continue. And I think it's important as we note the losses and defeats of social movements to also recognize their victories and the important advances through the mass movement over the last year and organizing of the Black Lives Matter movement.
That's right. It's been a very important victory, too, not just a superficial one. Getting control of a prosecutor's office and getting better prosecutors is key to really reforming or fundamentally changing our criminal justice system.
So this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about crime, violence, and politics as we enter into the hot summer of 2021 in the aftermath of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fight for decarceration. Whatever happened to the 8-hour day? Who feeds a family now on one person?